Hey everybody, before we get into today's episode, I want to take a minute to introduce our latest service called Crowd Insight by Gadgetflow. It's an awesome tool we made to help you get honest feedback for your upcoming crowdfunding project. Some of the big results we've seen include increased conversion rate, finding out why your project isn't performing well, and getting feedback you need from potential backers. So please head over to gadgetflow.com/crowdinsight to check it out today. You can also find a link in this week's show notes. Now, let's get into the episode. Hello, world. This is the Gadget Flow podcast, the show about everything related to products, entrepreneurship, marketing, and crowdfunding. This week, I got to sit down with Alex Ledoux, and Alex is a serial entrepreneur turned angel investor. And he has grown multiple million-dollar businesses, and he just turned 26 years old. So he's definitely an expert, and we asked him a bunch of questions about what it's like to build a business at that scale and what it's like to be a full-time angel investor. So super awesome interview. So without further ado, here is our interview with Alex Ledoux. All right, I am here with Alex Ledoux. Alex, how are you doing today, man?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing great. Doing great. We're so, so excited to have you on the Gadget Flow podcast this week. Maybe for our listeners who don't know who you are, maybe just give a little bit of background, who you are and what it is you do.
Yeah, absolutely. I can kind of give you the 2-minute overview. So I'm your pretty typical, stereotypical serial entrepreneur, mostly in the e-commerce space. So I've grown and sold three companies at this point, the biggest of which was a company called EcoFlower. So we were able to grow that to about 10 million in revenue and over 100 employees at the time of my exit. So I exited at the tail end of 2016. So EcoFlower was a company that made floral bouquets and home decor items made from recycled materials, so mostly wooden flowers. So after that exit, I ended up becoming the CEO of Ice.com, which is one of the largest online jewelers. They were actually the second company to bring jewelry online. Had good success there, but ended up wanting to pursue angel investing full time, which is kind of where I had always wanted to be. So ended up turning to angel investing full time. So now I'm just purely a strategic angel investor in the consumer goods space. Have five portfolio companies, four of which are in the consumer goods space, and always just looking for additional investment. So I really have a kind of a marketing and marketplace team that I come and put behind the businesses I get involved in. So it's both capital and strategic, as well as obviously the plug and play talent. So that's what I've been doing for the last, I guess, coming up on 18 months and really liking that and just continuing to look to scale that.
Awesome, man. So you're not busy or anything.
No, not at all.
Yeah, I'm just kidding, man. No, it sounds like, I mean, you have so much expertise and so much, you know, like history in business under your belt. So I'm just curious, how old are you, Alex?
I am 26. So I'll turn 27 in December.
Yeah, that's absolutely crazy how much you've done already. So I have a bunch of questions. But first, I kind of want to get your backstory. Like, how did you become interested in becoming an entrepreneur? What was kind of the first thing you started doing? How did you climb so high so fast? Just give me a little bit of, you know, maybe where you were when you're 16 moving into your 20s when you started making all these huge leaps.
Sure. So I really did all the stereotypical things growing up. Any business that a typical teenager would be doing, I was generally doing. So, you know, whether it was a lemonade stand in third grade or selling Pokemon and Yu-Gi-Oh cards and then working up to, you know, lawn mowing companies and that type of thing. So all of that was very typical through probably high school. In college, I'd say, is really where it started. I really took an interest to online marketing. And was able to kind of start having some freelance clients and start learning that side. That was really my background and what has kind of kicked off my success in the digital world. Before that, I guess in college, I was never much of a gamer, but my brother certainly was. So I saw an opportunity in electronic sports, which is known as esports. So I started a professional League of Legends team, which is actually one of my first exits. So what I did was, I didn't have any money. I was a broke college kid at the time. So I convinced a handful of kids, actually, you know, anywhere from 18 to 22 year olds, to put together a team on a profit sharing model. So we ended up opening a professional team in professional team house in Santa Monica, California, and played in all of the premier leagues and made our money much through like the NASCAR or any sponsorship model where, you know, we wore the logos on the jerseys and did endorsements. So we played in front of about 8 million people on a weekly basis. And we're able to scale that actually to a pretty good size. That was actually my first exit. I really saw the opportunity because my brother was always kind of watching these live streams and this underworld, under the radar market, but it's actually incredibly big. And now their viewerships are, you know, matching, you know, World Series or whatever it may be. So I saw an opportunity and kind of jumped on that. That was really my first dive into it. Made a ton of mistakes, but fortunately they weren't catastrophic. So was able to scale that to a pretty good size, as I said, but, really the opportunity I saw there was just that, you know, these players who are playing and practicing, you know, 12 to 16 hours a day, 6 to 7 days a week, you know, they were the ones running the business side. So I had, you know, been going to school for some business stuff and thought I had a little bit more capability than someone playing and just didn't have the time for it. So, that was really the biggest thing is I was kind of the first one in esports to look at it from a business perspective. So we made our money through sponsorships. We had, you know, we had the unknown version of Hot Pocket, the less known version of energy drinks, those type of things.
That's awesome.
Obviously all the, you know, the major, gaming companies, whether it's Razer or something like that, were behind us. But, that was certainly pretty fascinating, especially just because we were trying to, you know, we were hiring professional like actors and stuff to come in and train our, you know, our players to become a little bit more comfortable in front of the cameras, as that's obviously where we're making our money. So we were doing very like, I guess it was product placement that you could get away with, you know, 6 years ago. We literally just like set the drink in front of the screen.
Yes. That's awesome.
Very just like blatant and obvious. So I wish I was, you know, in the scene now, but that was really how I kind of got into it. And then from there, I really just realized like, oh, I really love the business side. Like this esports been cool and the community aspect's really, really awesome. But, you know, I think my digital marketing practices can be used elsewhere. And then after, actually it was like 7 days after I graduated college, I ended up co-founding EcoFlower. So it was really a pretty immediate transition after university.
Okay. So I'm curious, how old were you when you started EcoFlower? Like 22, 23?
Yeah, I would have been like 22.
Okay. So I'm curious how you grew and scaled EcoFlower. Like what, maybe, I know that there are so many things, we probably don't have time for all of them, but maybe give me like a few of the things that you did in order to scale such a large business at your age.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, the first thing I'll say is it was fortunate. It was a very, the viral coefficient of the product was great. And this was again, 5 years ago where social and organic was a little bit more relevant, right? Before these social platforms have totally almost turned to a pay to play model. So we were able to, in the first 12 months, experience pretty good growth purely on the organic sharing and viral coefficient factor, which certainly helped. But really it really just kind of compounded our marketing efforts. It was mostly through Facebook ads. We were able to scale the business, certainly was the biggest advocate, and then built a pretty good community. We ended up just kind of building a behind the scenes Facebook community, which we would promote through our, you know, email marketing and inserts and packages and obviously on our Facebook ads. And that was really that allowed us to really interact with our customer and build a good core community, which definitely directionalized our, you know, ourselves from a product development perspective. And then fortunately we were in the flower space, which really has a ton of, you know, core target markets, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, our bread and butter was the gift market initially for birthdays, anniversaries, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And then we were able to quickly expand that in obviously weddings, and the craft scene and that type of thing. So, but certainly through really good core digital marketing practices, I would say, Facebook was the biggest for us because it was a, you know, we were selling wood and flowers. So it's not like AdWords was very relevant. I mean, wood and flowers even today, you know, the search volume so low. So we were really going out and creating a market for our product because it was a product that had never, you know, previously really been seen. So that was probably the biggest thing is core digital marketing practices. And then just really being super hyper-focused on the product and the quality and the, you know, the experience and team. So we were definitely trying to build a brand and realized that was the only way we could expand. So, you know, our product was ever evolving, which is important in that space. And then, really just trying to put as much focus on a good customer experience, which is tough when you're scaling that fast. Right.
Right.
Sure. We, you know, angered plenty of customers along the way, but our intention was always good. And then obviously the seasonal spikes are probably the biggest thing. So, we learned a lot of lessons in that, certainly.
Yeah. So I'm curious what, out of all of that, what would you say was the most challenging part? And this can go for that company or, you know, ice.com, but what would you say is the most challenging part of building and scaling businesses like that? Like, what's the most challenging thing you faced personally? And maybe how did you overcome that challenge when you face it?
Sure. So I would say the biggest thing is the, certainly the biggest challenge is talent, right? So, and operational. So I honestly, when I first started the business in the business world, I didn't realize how challenging that aspect would be. But just the relationship part of it and actually growing and operational or running efficiently at that size, right? So towards my end of time at EcoFlyer, we had, you know, over 100 employees. Obviously many of which were, you know, low level, you know, labor, right? So just kind of your bare bone fulfillment and, you know, florist labor, but also a pretty good sized management team. So, obviously as you scale a business, your time as a, you know, a founder, kind of a key driver, becomes more limited. So it's, you know, the only way to actually scale efficiently in all the areas you need to scale efficiently is through the appropriate talent. So I would say really putting a focus on talent. I've had a much, I guess, higher degree of talent, in the management structure from business to business as I've, you know, done more and more just because I've realized the importance of it. And you know, the work hard, you know, the individuals who work hard and, you know, get stuff done only can get you so far. And, you know, the key is to find the people who work hard and live for it, but also have an incredible skill set, right? And they do exist. They're hard to find and they can be expensive, but generally if they're managed appropriately, they can be very worthwhile. So I would say that's probably the biggest thing. And then just running efficiently at that, right? So, you know, at EcoFlyer, obviously labor was a big part of our cost, right?
Right.
Just on the actual making the product. And there's natural tendencies for your labor efficiencies to decrease as things scale, which obviously can kind of mess with your unit economics. So I would say just putting a really big focus on building a very strong core team and make sure you have processes and organizational structure that allows you to scale appropriately.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious if you could give some insight into how to find good talent. What did you learn about that process? Like how to decide, like, is this person the right fit for what we're doing?
Sure. That's a great question. So, I'll walk you through the whole process. So the immediate thing was obviously just using, you know, job boards, right? Whether it's Indeed or, whatever it may be. And then really realized that, you know, that's only half of the battle. Started certainly implementing some sort of, headhunting processes. And I mean, that's not rocket science. Obviously just utilizing LinkedIn, and going out and finding the right people, had fairly good success with that. Obviously it's kind of hit or miss. And oftentimes you're trying to, you know, snipe or steal them potentially from a, you know, a company, that treats them very well. So it can sometimes that transition over can be, you know, can be one that can be hard to fight for. And then on the actual hiring side, I think that the biggest thing is, you know, whether, you know, everyone thinks they have great instincts and they can read people and all of that, but the art of interviewing is flawed, right? And it's very hard to, especially for some of these very skill set based, you know, whether it's someone in, you know, whether it's a developer or, you know, a chief marketing officer or something like that. It's a very hard job to interview for. Right. So, right. I've had pretty good success with using skill like tests, whether it's case studies or something, and implementing that in the inventory or sorry, in the interview process to make sure it just as a way to double check, to verify, to make sure their skill set is where you think they are. So I've definitely been able to improve the skill set test and make it more so it's, you know, not hit or miss, but really it's hard to come up with a skill set test in a, you know, in an area you don't know. So that would probably be my biggest advice is on that side, just really making sure that you're not just purely basing it off of the interview. Because there's a lot of people who, you know, will claim they, you know marketing, right? And can maybe talk the game, but can they actually deliver is a whole different level. I would say that's probably the biggest element. And then just certainly be willing to, you know, unfortunately, not every relationship works out. And sometimes that can be on the employer, sometimes that can be on the employee. So, you know, being very crucial and very critical of the first 30 days and being, you know, very upfront, you know, that this is definitely a test, right? You're testing if you like to work for us, we're testing if we like to work, you know, like to work with you. And, you know, be willing to, unfortunately, you know, pull the plug when you have to. If it doesn't work, obviously you'll go through the mechanisms of, you know, verifying and giving chances and trying to train and having those harder conversations. But it doesn't always work out. And I see oftentimes, you know, people maybe feel bad about it and now they're stuck with a, you know, executive level talent that, the company really can't, you know, afford, if it's not being spent correctly. Right. So, just being very, very upfront that it's a test stage and making sure the relationship works, you know, in the first 30 days. And if not, you know, moving forward or moving in a different direction.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, man. So I'm curious, because you know your stuff, and I'm curious, what was the turning point that made you decide you wanted to become a full-time angel investor? Instead of running companies, maybe you're just wanting to invest in them. What was that moment when you decided that?
Sure. There's a couple elements to it. One is obviously having the capital to do so, right? And exits have allowed me to do that. But I think the second part is although I love the startup grind, right? And it's one of those things that I feel like it's kind of a once in a lifetime experience, right? And it's like it's the most overbearing thing when you're doing it, and then you look back at it and you kind of, you know, it becomes appealing. I don't know if I ever want to go through that again from up, right?
Yeah.
I just think it, you know, is so much more enjoyable to come in at the stage that I come in, which is, you know, generally you know, late seed or early stage, you know, whether it's stage A or whatever you want. And oftentimes I'm working with individuals who aren't, you know, super familiar with the investor process. So, but relatively, I guess you could say early on, but they're to a point where they have some level of foundation. They're to a point where, you know, they validated the product or the market fit. And now, you know, now it's just, you know, attacking low hanging fruit on the marketing side or going after, you know, huge gaps in their target markets or, you know, just big ways to develop the business. But without that foundation, it's just so tough, right? It's literally, you know, the founder or the founders with no money, you know, in a garage, and, you know, they have all these ideas but just can't execute on anything because they're literally fulfilling the orders and don't have any, you know, foundation. So, so although that's thrilling, you know, I, you know, certainly it's so much more enjoyable to come in a little bit later when they've already had some level of foundation and then be able to aggressively scale that. Mm-hmm. I love the scaling element.
Yeah.
You have to have a business that's ready to be scaled. And there's certainly some criteria that have to be checked off to make that relevant.
Yeah, absolutely, man. I think you paid your dues, your startup dues, and now you're able to come in and use that expertise to help grow other people's businesses, you know, and get a chunk of that, which is awesome. So I'm curious I'm thinking of, you know, 18, 19 year old, maybe in college, who is considering launching a business. And I want to know, what is the most important thing for them to maybe focus on when they're launching their first product or business? Or whatever it is that they're wanting to launch. What do you think is the most important thing for them to focus on?
Sure. So I mean, obviously it kind of depends industry and product, but I guess broad stroke, being data driven, right? So, and I made these same mistakes when I started. Everyone loves to go make business decisions based off of anecdotal, you know, feelings or emotions or, you know, small, you know, sample sizes, right? Family and friends that, you know, speak well of the product. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think being data driven and using that from the top down. So, you know, I oftentimes see, you know, both side on the bootstrap, but also, you know, I oftentimes see, you know, I probably look at, I don't know, 5 to 10 businesses on a weekly basis and pretty consistently see businesses that have spent, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars developing a product that they have no clue if there's actually a market fit, right? So being super hyper-focused on the data side, I think there's a couple easy ways to do this. The first would be obviously like surveys. I think surveys can be done very well, and I think they can be done very poorly. And at the end of the day, you know, just because someone says they're, you know, willing to spend $300 for this product doesn't mean they are, right? So I would look at the survey results with kind of a grain of salt. But overall, I think you can get some pretty good insight on the best way to, you know, navigate forward with it. So I think that's certainly a part of it. I would say that's the being data driven, using surveys, but also using, you know, paid ad platforms, right? So for a lot of these, you know, inventions or whatever it may be, you know, there's not necessarily a, you know, an existing market. So you're kind of creating a market. So your primary source for kind of top of funnel is probably going to be Facebook. So it's okay to run Facebook ads, you know, without actually having a completed product, right? And just testing different things. Maybe you're testing the, you know, core features of the product. Maybe you're testing the design of the product. Maybe you're testing the name of the product. Price points, whatever it is, but just being very data driven, obviously testing kind of one variance at a time, and seeing what works or what doesn't work, right? And it can literally be spending, you know, $5 to $10 running, you know, six different series of Facebook ads, and going to a website that, you know, doesn't even, or a landing page that, you know, doesn't even work, or a landing page that's just trying to capture emails and saying sorry, you know, not available in your area or whatever it may be. But using that as a way to judge level of interest. Instead of just being purely anecdotal. So there's really very cheap and effective ways to be able to test target market. So I think that's the biggest thing, is make sure your target market is, you know, you actually have one. And then really the entire business comes down to, you know, the unit economics, right? So on a high level, you know, obviously if you have a website that maybe has 20 sales, you can start to gather this data. And this would be data, you know, such as like, you know, what is your average order value? And then obviously, what is your profit on that? And then ultimately, you know, what does it take to acquire a customer? And there's obviously different elements that go into each of these components, but making sure you have kind of a working model as far as unit economics. And with that, thinking in a, you know, scalable fashion, you can't forever be the one shipping the product. You can't forever be the one, you know, handling customer service. You can't forever be the one, you know, doing all your marketing. So those type of things. So thinking scalable, making sure you have a good market fit, and then making sure your unit economics work. Ultimately, a business purely comes down to, you know, if the unit economics work. And, you know, if you have a terrible product, that's going to show up in reviews, or that's going to show up in bad press. And that's going to, you know, kind of destroy a certain component of your unit economics. So, at the end of the day, I really look and evaluate businesses based on, you know, their unit economics, and how well I think I can scale the marketing side.
Yeah, no, that's great advice. I think figuring out whether or not there's a market before you just believe blindly that there is a market, I think is so key. But I also think it's a huge fallacy that people, you know, deal with every day, is just assuming because you think it's a good idea or a good product or whatever that other people will too. I love that advice of just even doing the paid ad thing to validate that there is actually interest in your product with the different variations and things like that. I think that's awesome, man. So what is next for you? Like, what's coming up for you? What's going on in your world? What are you excited about that's coming up?
Sure. So I've actually finally kind of put together my investment firm, working with a couple key other individuals with very similar backgrounds to me. So we're actually launching that website today, exciting enough. So it'll be Karta, K-A-R-T-A, ventures.com. So really, we've had really good success on deal flow without really ever putting a central effort on the investment firm, or without, you know, having case studies or more about the team or anything like that. So we're really just centralizing those and trying to get as aggressive as we can on the deal flow side, because we've really been able to systemize the processes and, you know, feel like we can scale the marketing efforts for a lot of businesses. So we're very excited on in that aspect, and ready to certainly find our next deal.
That's awesome, man. So okay, what was the website again? The URL?
KartaVentures.com, KARTA Ventures.com.
Awesome. And that'll be in the show notes for everyone listening. So make sure to go check that out. And are you on Twitter, Instagram, any of those handles? Do you care about those things where people can get in touch with you?
I'm not. I think the best way would probably just be through cardaventures.com.
Awesome.
You can certainly connect via there. But no, I'm more of just a LinkedIn guy. So.
All right, man, that works. Well, Alex, thank you so much for being on, man. I think you're obviously a total expert at what you do, and we appreciate all the advice you've given us today on the Gadget Flow podcast. So thank you so much for being on, man. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, no, thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That was my interview with Alex Ledoux, so please make sure to check out everything he's working on at Carta Ventures and make sure to connect with them online. Thank you so much for being on this week, Alex. This podcast is made by Gadget Flow, and we are proud to be the number one platform to find new and awesome gadgets. So make sure to check out our site for all the new products we're curating every single day. We'll be back next week with another new episode, so in the meantime, please go rate and review our show on iTunes. Until next time, thank you so much for listening to the Gadget Flow podcast.